Everyone here is well aware of the significant effect that black holes play in astrophysics today. What I'd like to do is to describe the important role that black holes play in quantum gravity. Theorists like to find simple models for things, and a black hole reminds me of a harmonic oscillator. On the one hand, it's classically very simple. The exact solutions to general relativity are known and depend on only a few parameters. On the other hand, they seem to illustrate some of the major features in quantum gravity. Now, you might ask, why does a black hole have this unique property of illustrating features of quantum gravity? And a rough picture is, A rough picture is the following. Imagine a star undergoing gravitational collapse. We know, at least in the classical theory, it collapses all the way down to a singularity, indicated by this wavy line. And, of course, it forms a black hole with its event horizon indicated there. Now, we know that light rays, outgoing light rays, starting very close to the horizon, follow trajectories indicated here, and in particular, light rays which are very close together near the horizon end up quite far apart when you're far from the black hole. So black holes are like a giant magnifying glass, which allow us to see the effects of very short distances very close to the horizon. Of course, the first indication that black holes might play a role or give us some insight in quantum gravity was Hawking's famous calculation of black hole radiation back in 1974. At that time, some people speculated that black holes might be a key to quantum gravity. And it turns out that within this past year, this speculation has been spectacularly confirmed. It turns out that by studying black holes in the context of string theory, we have been led to a more complete formulation of the entire theory. And this is what I'd like to tell you about today, this result and the events that led up to it. But before I do, I have to say that string theorists don't think about 10 dimensions and discuss bizarre objects like D-brains because they've lost touch with reality. They are trying to resolve a crisis in 20th century physics. Everyone here is very comfortable using general relativity and quantum mechanics to understand their astrophysical observations. But we can't lose sight of the fact that those two theories are fundamentally inconsistent. And it has proved very difficult to find a unifying framework which combines both general relativity and quantum mechanics. And one of the very few promising possibilities is string theory. And string theorists are sort of being led to these bizarre possibilities, these bizarre ideas, because that's where the theory is driving us, not because we just like strange things. Now, there is, I should say, another approach to quantum gravity, which goes under the name of quantum geometry. This is, at the moment, quite separate from string theory. I'm not going to have time to discuss it today, but one of the goals of the six-month program, which is currently underway at the ITP, is to try to see whether some of the ideas of quantum geometry can be combined with the current ideas in string theory in a fruitful way. I also should say that there are other topics which might go under the name of quantum aspects of black holes, which I will not have time to talk about. And among them are certain calculations which calculate the quantum mechanical probability for creating a pair of charged black holes in a background electric field, or even a pair of magnetically charged black holes in a background magnetic field. Those calculations have shown that it is astrophysically unimportant that this process take place, but theoretically it is of some interest that they seem to be possible at very low probabilities. Okay, so to tell you about these recent developments in string theory, Let me start by just reminding you of a couple of basic properties of black holes in general relativity. As you know, in general relativity, stationary black holes are uniquely determined by just three parameters: their mass, angular momentum, and charge. The final state of a black hole is completely independent of what collapsed to form it. And Wheeler characterized this state of affairs with his famous phrase, "Black holes have no hair." For a stationary black hole, it's possible to define a quantity known as the surface gravity. And roughly speaking, you can think of this as follows. You take your black hole, you take a very strong rope, you attach a mass to it and lower the mass close to the event horizon of the black hole. Locally, the force on the mass will diverge, but out here at infinity, a large distance from the black hole, the force you have to exert on a unit mass is finite, and the limit as the mass approaches the black hole, and that's known as the surface gravity. And people studied properties of black holes in the early 70s, and I think it was Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking who first formulated these properties of black holes in terms of laws they called the laws of black hole mechanics. And these laws took the following form. There was a zeroth law, which said that the surface gravity is constant on over the event horizon. This, of course, isn't surprising for a spherically symmetric black hole, but it turned out to be true for rotating black holes as well. There was no difference between the surface gravity on the equator and the poles. If you take a stationary black hole and throw in a little bit of matter, of course, the parameters of the black hole will change. You have a small change in the mass, the angular momentum, and the charge. And they showed that the change in the mass was equal to the surface gravity times the change in the area of the event horizon divided by 8 pi times Newton's constant, plus a term which involved the quantity omega, which was the angular velocity of the horizon, times the change in the angular momentum, plus a term phi, which was the electrostatic potential at the horizon, times the change in the charge. And finally, Hawking showed that there was another law which says that the area of the event horizon does not decrease. And as I said, these were laws of black hole mechanics. Of course, it did not escape anyone's attention that there was a remarkable similarity between those laws and the ordinary laws of thermodynamics, which of course say that the temperature is constant over an object in thermal equilibrium. The change in the energy is the temperature times the change in the entropy, plus work terms, and that the entropy does not decrease for isolated systems. So there is this close analogy with the surface gravity somehow playing the role of a temperature and the area of the event horizon somehow playing the role of an entropy. But at the time, it was thought that this could be no more than an analogy because a black hole couldn't have a real temperature. If it did, it would have to radiate, and everyone knew that nothing could come out of a black hole. Well, of course, that all changed in 1974 when Hawking showed that quantum mechanically, black holes do emit thermal radiation with a temperature which he calculated to be Planck's constant times the surface gravity divided by 2 pi. If you simply plug that value of the temperature into this analogy between the laws of black hole mechanics and the laws of thermodynamics, you conclude that black holes really are thermodynamic systems with an entropy equal to the area of their event horizon divided by 4 times Planck's constant times Newton's constant. If you plug in the numbers, you find for a solar mass black hole that this Hawking temperature is extremely low, 10 to the minus 7 degrees Kelvin, and this black hole entropy is extremely high, 10 to the 77. Now, to get an idea of how big that number is, we can compare this black hole entropy with the entropy of matter, and let's compare this entropy with the entropy of thermal radiation at the point where the radiation is about to form a black hole. So imagine a big sphere of thermal radiation and let it collapse down, and at the point when it's about to form a black hole, we're going to compare the entropy in the radiation with the entropy of the black hole that it forms. And to make life simple here, I'm going to set all the fundamental constants equal to 1, and so this is what theorists like to do. It'll be using Planck units, but it gets the right scaling, and we'll see the results at the end. So we know that the energy, or the mass, of a sphere of thermal radiation, it just goes like T to the fourth times the volume, R cubed. This sphere will form a black hole when its mass is confined inside a radius, where R is of order of the mass. And if you plug that into here, you find that you form a black hole when the radius is of order of the mass, and they both go like 1 over the temperature squared. That implies that the entropy in the radiation, which of course is T cubed times the volume, if you plug that in here, R goes like T to the minus 2, you get, well, relating it back to the mass, you see that this goes like mass to the 3/2, but the black hole entropy is going like the area of the event horizon, and the area of the event horizon we know grows like the mass squared. And so just comparing these last two results, you see that whenever the mass is bigger than 1 in Planck units, in other words, whenever the black hole has a mass bigger than 10 to the minus 5 grams, the black hole entropy is much larger than the entropy of the radiation that formed it. So this raised quite a puzzle. In all other contexts, thermodynamics is just an approximation to a more fundamental description based on statistical physics. And so the challenge, which lasted for more than 20 years, was to find this more fundamental description. And in this more fundamental description, the entropy is supposed to be related to the log of the number of states. And so one would like to know, where are these huge numbers of states associated or implied by the black hole entropy? In other words, people were faced with the question, what is the origin of black hole entropy? Well, this question has recently been answered in string theory. And I should say there's also been an answer provided in this alternative approach to quantum geometry. The answer in string theory starts by considering extremely charged black holes. Now, we heard this morning that charged black holes are not astrophysically very interesting because in real life, a charged black hole will quickly neutralize itself by accretion. But theoretically, they're very interesting and a very useful starting point to try to understand black hole entropy. So first of all, let me just remind you that charged black holes cannot have an arbitrarily large charge for their given mass. There is, in fact, an upper limit on the charge. And black holes with the maximum charge for their mass are known as extremal black holes. And they have, in appropriate units, the property that the mass is just a multiple of the charge. The reason that these particular black holes are theoretically very interesting is that they're quantum mechanically stable. The Hawking temperature is zero, and so they don't radiate. They nevertheless have non-zero horizon area, implying a large entropy, and so it might seem like this is the simplest type of black hole to try to understand the entropy of, because one doesn't have to worry about the complications of Hawking radiation at the same time. Well, Steve Giddings gave a nice review of some of the basics of string theory this morning, but let me just remind you of a couple of facts that we're going to need. So first of all, there is this string coupling, which is a parameter in the theory. It's actually related to a dynamical field, so it can change, but for our purposes, we can think of it as a constant which governs the strength of string interactions. There's also a dimensionful parameter in string theory, which Steve called the string mass, I'll call the string length. It has the same origin. It comes from the tension of the string itself. It's a new dimensionful parameter in the theory. And other parameters that we're familiar with, such as Newton's constant, are not independent. But Newton's constant is actually related to the square of the string coupling times the square of the string length. Also, as Steve discussed, string theory predicts that space has more than three dimensions. We don't see those extra dimensions simply because they're curled up in a very small volume, such as a soda straw seen at a very large distance. This is actually a very old idea. It goes back to the 1920s when Kaluza and Klein pointed out that if you take a theory of pure gravity in four-space and one-time dimension and compactify one direction on a circle, the effective theory you see in three spatial dimensions looks just like general relativity coupled to electromagnetism. They also pointed out that particles which are moving in this extra dimension would appear like charged particles from the standpoint of the three-dimensional observer. So it's an attractive idea at unification. Steve also mentioned that string theory is supersymmetric. That means it has the symmetry which relates fermions and bosons. And he discussed that in supersymmetric theories, there is a relation between the mass and the charge of all states. The mass must be greater than or equal to some multiple of the charge. And states which saturate this, which the mass is equal to a multiple of the charge, are special. They are called BPS states. And they have the property that the mass does not receive any quantum corrections. It's uniquely fixed in terms of the charge. So now we can think about the connection with black holes. And the idea is to imagine all possible string states, all BPS states, where the mass is equal to a multiple of the charge, and we'll assume that this charge is large. Well, when the string coupling is zero, this is very easy to describe. We now have turned off gravity. In fact, we've turned off all interactions. So we have essentially a free theory. We're just working in flat space, and we can describe these states of the string where the mass is equal to the charge. Now we can imagine increasing the coupling. So we think of this as sort of a mathematical exercise in the theory. We turn up the value of the string coupling. That turns on gravity, and if we make the coupling large enough, we make gravity strong enough that these states will turn into black holes. The mass doesn't change, so the black hole we create will also have a mass which is equal to the same multiple of the charge. But we've already seen that there's only one black hole in general relativity for a given mass and a given charge. So all of these different states go into the same black hole at strong coupling. And this is the key point. General relativity provides only a very crude description of the quantum state at strong coupling. And this is the nature or the origin of the thermodynamic behavior. One has many, many microstates, many different quantum states, which all look the same if you look at it just in terms of the space-time geometry. Well, of course, the key question is, how many string states do you have where the mass is equal to this multiple of the charge? And that calculation was done in 1996. And Strominger and Vaffa found that the number of string states is precisely the exponential of this Hawking-Bekenstein entropy, the black hole entropy of the black hole you form at strong coupling. So one had confirmation of these thermodynamic ideas now in the context of a theory in which one could actually count the quantum states directly. And this is the first time that a calculation of this sort was done. Well, as you can imagine, this attracted a lot of attention, and people immediately tried to generalize this result to see what other properties of black holes one could reproduce. So within a few months of the Strominger-Vaffa calculation, people had checked a number of cases. So for technical reasons, the calculation that Strominger and Vaffa did concerned a black hole in five dimensions. So these are five non-compact, four-space, one-time non-compact dimensions. In the context of string theory, any extra dimension you needed was compactified on a torus or some small volume. So their calculation was a five-dimensional extreme black hole with no angular momentum. Well, it was shown that this counting of string states agrees with the black hole entropy if you add angular momentum, keeping the black hole extremal. So this was five-dimensional extreme rotating black holes. It was then shown that you could go slightly away from extremality, add a little bit of extra energy, and the agreement still worked. The counting still reproduced the entropy. It was then shown that five dimensions was not really essential. You could go to four dimensions, the usual three-space, one-time black holes, and the counting agreed. You could go to four-dimensional, slightly non-extremal black holes and rotating black holes, and the agreement still worked. This was work done by many, many people, some of whom are in this room. I should emphasize that this agreement is even better than it looks, because it's not one number which is agreeing in each of these cases, but whole functions. For example, the four-dimensional black hole can actually carry different types of charge. Turns out that in string theory you have not just a charge associated with the usual electromagnetism, but you have other types of charges, other Maxwell-like fields in the theory, and you can have black holes with up to four different charges. When you go away from extremality, you have excess energy as well, and so you have the entropy as a function of five parameters. And it turns out that as a function of these five parameters, the counting of string states at weak coupling agrees with the area of the horizon that you compute in general relativity at strong coupling. Well, let me say a little bit more about this picture of black holes that string theory gives us at weak coupling. If you go to weak coupling, what you find is that these charged black holes are described by something called D-brains that Steve discussed a little bit this morning. D-brains should be thought of as solitons. They are like, you might think of them as solitons. They are charged objects, and in the weak coupling limit, they live in flat space, and they have the property that strings can end on them. So you have these open strings which can move around on the D-brain. So if you take your charged black hole and go to weak coupling, you find that your charges are represented by these D-brains. These D-brains are extended in space, but you can wrap them around your internal directions. So if all the extended directions of your D-brain are wrapped around your small circles, they look like ordinary point objects from the standpoint of ordinary three-dimensional space. To construct one of these extreme black holes in string theory, it turns out that you need to add some of these open strings all moving in the same direction along the brain. And because they're moving in one of these internal directions, they look like another charge from the standpoint of the three-dimensional world that we see. And so this is one of the charges on the black hole. So the extreme black hole is pictured as a D-brain wrapped around some small circle with little open strings moving around all in the same direction. And you count the number of ways you can put these states of the string for a given total momentum in the internal direction, which is like a given total charge, and you get the entropy of the extreme black hole. When you go to the near extreme black hole, you add a little bit of extra energy to the system. And what that does is it excites these open strings which can move in either direction. So rather than just having strings moving to the right, you can now have strings moving to the left as well as the right. And the entropy at weak coupling, well, these left-moving strings are largely non-interacting with the right-moving strings. You think of these as two independent populations, and the entropy should be just the sum of the entropy of the left-moving strings and the right-moving strings. And you might think there's no way that that sum of two terms coming from these two different types of objects could ever reproduce something like an area, which is one integral of the area of an event horizon. But surprisingly, when you look at the black hole with exactly the masses and charges implied by this picture, you find that the area of the event horizon does break up into two terms, one of which is exactly the entropy associated with left movers, and one of them agrees with the entropy associated with the right movers. Well, at weak coupling, these populations are largely non-interacting, but there is a small probability that a left-moving string will combine with a right-moving string to form a closed string, which then has no loose ends. It has no endpoints. It can then propagate off into space and leave the D-brain. Well, this is like a decay of some excited D-brain, and it is the weak coupling analog of Hawking radiation. So given the striking similarity between the entropy calculations that one gets in this D-brain picture and the black hole picture, the next question is obviously to ask, how does the radiation from this excited D-brain compare with the radiation that you compute using Hawking's techniques from black holes? And so this was looked at, and the following results were found. First of all, one finds that in both cases, the radiation is approximately thermal with the same temperature. This might seem surprising, but it's really not a new surprise. It follows just from the fact that we've already seen that the entropies of the excited D-brains and the near-extremal black holes are the same as a function of the energy. What is surprising is that the overall coefficient in the rate of radiation agrees. And this was first shown by Das and Mathur. So the total sort of amount of radiation coming off is the same in the D-brain picture at weak coupling and the black hole picture at strong coupling. But what's really remarkable is that the deviations from the black body spectrum also turn out to agree. This was first shown by Maldacena and Strominger. You see, in neither case does one really predict an exact black body spectrum. In the black hole case, one can imagine that the radiation near the event horizon starts off thermal, but then it has to propagate through the curved space-time geometry around the black hole. And this curvature in the space-time produces an effective potential, which the radiation has to propagate through, and by the time it gets out to infinity, the spectrum has been shifted. The curvature introduces a frequency-dependent sort of gray body factor, as it's called. In the weakly coupled D-brain picture, you start off with essentially independent left and right moving modes along your D-brain, and they can have different temperatures. And so the radiation that you get that way is also not exactly thermal. Well, the surprise is that when you do the calculation of what this gray body factor is to see what the radiation you would see at infinity from this near-extremal black hole, you get exact agreement with the calculation that you do in string theory at weak coupling to see what the spectrum is of radiation from the D-brain. The calculations couldn't look more different. On the one hand, you're solving a wave equation in curved space and have to invoke hypergeometric functions and all that stuff. And in the other case, you're doing some string theory perturbation calculation. At the end of the day, the answers agree. Well, this was clearly good news. But it wasn't the end of the story, and there remained a number of difficulties. The first one is, why is this working? You see, at the time it was happening, nobody asked this question, because we were all too happy. We were all doing calculations, finding agreement, and giving talks. Look, it agrees. Isn't this great? But after a while, you have to sit back and say, why is this working? On the face of it, it looks like you have two different descriptions valid in different regimes which don't overlap. At weak coupling, and here I've denoted the weak coupling sort of more precisely by not saying that G is small, but G times the charge, or G times the number of D-brains, if you want, is small. That is the effective coupling which governs this, this theory. So when the string coupling times the charge is much less than 1, you're in this weak coupling regime in which you have D-brains in flat space, you have your open strings, and as Steve Giddings explained this morning, the low energy excitations of the D-brain are really described by something called a gauge theory. This is just a generalization of ordinary Maxwell theory when you have, many gauge bosons which are interacting. So you have this gauge theory description, which is really what one's counting when one counts the states of the D-brain. It's the states of this gauge theory. When you go over to strong coupling, when this product of the string coupling times the charge is much bigger than 1, you find a black hole. And this black hole is, we'll say an extremal black hole, has the property that if you take a moment of time, a t equals constant surface, the horizon is actually infinitely far away from any point outside the horizon. In other words, the geometry of an extreme black hole has this rather strange structure that there's this asymptotically flat region here, but when you come in toward the horizon, the space, the sort of surface seems to sort of go down into a bottomless throat. And the horizon is really infinitely far down this throat. Of course, it turns out that observers following time-like trajectories can still cross the horizon in a finite time. Light particles cross the horizon in a finite time. So the black hole is still there in a real sense as part of our universe, but nevertheless, in this sort of spatial direction, it's infinitely far away. Well, one has these two pictures. One is valid when the coupling is weak. One is valid when the coupling is strong. How can we hope to do some calculation here and deduce anything about the black hole there? Well, I said in the case where you are actually talking about extreme black holes, we have an argument, and the argument is based on supersymmetry, that the mass isn't going to change. We can count the states at weak coupling. The number of states shouldn't change. The description might change, as it does here, but we can hope, well, we can argue that the number of states we calculate at weak coupling must agree with the number of states that actually exist at strong coupling, even though we can't sort of see them in detail. So that worked for the extreme black holes, but what about these non-extreme black hole calculations where you don't really have supersymmetry? And what about this radiation calculations, which clearly, you know, are not in the supersymmetric case? Well, that was a bit of a puzzle. A second difficulty was that the quantum states were all described at weak coupling, when your space-time is flat and you have no analog of the event horizon. So you can't begin to ask questions such as, what is the effect of the quantum states, what is the effect on the quantum states of the black hole of some matter or someone falling into the black hole? You have a description of the quantum states only in this regime where you basically don't have a black hole. So these were clearly limitations of the approach as it existed as of a bit more than a year ago. However, late last year, well, about a year ago, a young theorist named Juan Maldacena gave us a solution to these difficulties. And his idea was to take a low energy limit of this process. In this weak coupling regime, we have this gauge theory, which describes the excitations of the D-brains, but of course we have the usual closed strings, which propagate around space. And what Juan showed is that in this weak coupling regime, if you take a certain low energy limit, the gauge theory completely decouples from the other string modes. That sounds like you're turning off Hawking radiation. You're not allowing the sort of D-brain to decay, and in a sense, that's exactly what you're doing. This low-energy regime is, in a sense, approaching an extremal limit in which you don't have any Hawking radiation, but there's a subtlety, which I will, don't have time to go into, which allows you to take a low-energy limit in which you keep the dynamics, some non-trivial dynamics on the brains, but decouple the closed strings and the rest of the theory. When you do that same limit in this other regime of large coupling, it turns out to focus attention, it causes you to focus on the space-time very close to the horizon. Remember, the actual event horizon is infinitely far down this throat, and so this low energy limit means you're looking at the region of space-time very, very far down this throat. Now, what does that region look like? Well, if you take the near horizon geometry of an extreme charged black hole and ask, okay, the geometry is a little complicated, there's an asymptotically flat region, a horizon, and all that, but if you focus right near the horizon, down this throat, you find that the space-time becomes very simple, and in fact, the metric just becomes a product of a sphere and something called anti-de Sitter space. Anti-de Sitter space is a solution to Einstein's equation with negative cosmological constant. Its cosmological constant is minus some number divided by the string coupling times the charge all to the 1/2. And these are in, essentially Planck units, So when this G times Q is small, this cosmological constant is enormous, bigger than Planck curvature. When this is large, the cosmological constant can be small. Anti-de-Sitter space is in fact a space of constant negative curvature, so it's maximally symmetric. It in fact is the analog of, well, a sphere in some sense. A sphere has constant positive curvature, anti-de-Sitter space has constant negative curvature, but of course the metric on the sphere is positive definite, and the metric on anti-de-Sitter space is Lorentzian. This is the part that includes the time direction. Okay, so if we take this weak coupling limit, we have a gauge theory at weak coupling. At strong coupling, we're looking at strings moving in this geometry, which is just the sphere times anti-de-Sitter space. But the key point is that the gauge theory also exists at strong coupling. And so if you just take the gauge theory and let the coupling become strong, you now have two descriptions valid for the same range of parameters. So in this low energy, strong coupled limit of the theory, you have the black hole description in which strings are moving on this anti-de-Sitter space, and a gauge theory description. And so that led to Maldacena's famous conjecture that string theory on anti-de-Sitter space, that's what ADS is, it's just anti-de-Sitter space time, cross a compact space like a sphere that I just described, is completely described by a supersymmetric gauge theory living on the boundary at infinity. Now, I'll explain what that phrase in quotes means in just a few minutes. But there are actually several forms of this conjecture because of the different types of black holes that you can start with. One, just if you want to see a concrete example, I'm not going to need this for anything, so you don't have to worry, but one particular case is if you take string theory on a five-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space across a five-dimensional sphere, that is supposed to be completely described, i.e. equivalent to an SUN supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, that's just one of these gauge theories, in four space-time dimensions. Now, these gauge theories are very familiar to particle physicists because they're the basis of the standard model of elementary particles. And now what this theory is, what this conjecture is saying, as this is that this very ordinary-looking field theory is completely equivalent to all of string theory on this space. Well, it sounds crazy. It sounds completely crazy, but it's not obviously wrong. And the way to see that it's not obviously wrong is to notice that in the regime that we really understand what gauge theory is, which is this weakly coupled regime, the corresponding space-time, I said, that's when this Q times G is small, the corresponding space-time has enormous curvature. The cosmological constant is big compared to the Planck scale. So we have no idea what string theory is supposed to do on a space-time which is so highly curved. In the other limit, when G times Q is very large and the space-time curvature is small and we have a very good idea of what string theory is supposed to be like, the gauge theory is very strongly coupled. And we have no idea of what the gauge theory is supposed to be like. So there is this strong coupling, weak coupling duality, which Steve Giddings talked about this morning in other contexts, which is at work here as well. Well, this conjecture, as crazy as it sounds, has unleashed a sort of storm of activity in the string community. As of yesterday, over 500 papers had been written exploring the consequences and testing this conjecture. Even by the exaggerated standards of particle physics, this is a lot of activity. And so far, no contradictions have been found, no inconsistencies have been found. We certainly don't have a proof yet, but it's remarkable to me that after all of this activity and all of this checks, it is still standing. And it is still viable, and in fact, many people are coming around to actually believing that it's true. So, what does this tell us now? This is a new definition of string theory, if you want. It's a non-perturbative definition of string theory. For a long time, all we knew of string theory was certain rules for calculating perturbative scattering of strings. By saying that string theory really is just this ordinary field theory exists in all dimensions, in all coupling, this gives a non-perturbative definition of string theory. What kind of theory is this in terms of what we're really interested in, which is quantum gravity? Well, this is a holographic theory of quantum gravity. This idea has been discussed earlier, most notably by Susskind and Tehuft, who pointed out that ordinary field theories, of course, and ordinary systems have entropies which grow like the volume. That's a reflection of the fact that you have local degrees of freedom at each point in space, and if you make your volume bigger, you have more states, you have more entropy. Black holes, on the other hand, have an entropy which is proportional to the area of their event horizon. And they suggested that perhaps that's indicative of a general property of quantum gravity, that systems should have entropies which grow like the area. In other words, the fundamental degrees of freedom should live on the boundary and not in the bulk, not in the interior. Well, Moldacena's conjecture gives us a concrete formulation of this holographic idea. And the reason is that anti-de Sitter space looks a bit like the following. If you imagine rescaling distances to bring infinity into a finite distance, all of anti-de Sitter space looks a lot like the interior of this cylinder. So here time is plotted vertically and space is horizontally. This sphere, or this cylinder on the boundary, is r equals infinity. That's infinite distance away in the actual metric. And all of space-time, the anti-de Sitter space-time, is in this interior. The gauge theory is, in some sense, thought to live on this boundary at infinity. So it lives just at infinity, and by doing calculations in the gauge theory, you're supposed to be able to reconstruct all of physics, all the processes which take place in the interior. That's the idea of the hologram. You look at the hologram, and you see a three-dimensional image behind. In this context, you look at a theory which is living sort of on the boundary, and you can reconstruct all of physics taking place inside. But people expect that this hologram has only a finite resolution, like any real hologram would. In other words, we expect that we can reconstruct ordinary local physics inside only down to a certain scale. But beyond that, things are going to be fuzzy. We're not going to be able to get arbitrarily small locality, causality, etc., which is just what you'd expect from a theory of quantum gravity. Well, this gauge theory, you might say, well, anti-de Sitter space is not so interesting, but let me point out that this gauge theory is supposed to describe all finite energy processes in this background, including the formation of Schwarzschild or Kerr black holes and the properties of accretion disks, all in a universe with negative cosmological constant. Now, you might say, in light of the recent high Z supernova observations, that what you'd really like is a theory which gives you these processes in a universe with positive cosmological constant. That is under investigation. We would very much like to have some analog of this conjecture for spacetimes which are asymptotically flat, or perhaps, you know, have a positive cosmological constant. But it's been recently pointed out by Joe Polchinski and Lenny Susskind that this restriction to negative cosmological constant is not really essential, in the sense that we can take lambda to be arbitrarily small and then think of this so small, in fact, that it should have no physical effect on any of these processes we want to study, and then think of it as just some sort of large distance cutoff. If the scale of the curvature associated with this negative cosmological constant is many, many orders of magnitude bigger than the scale of the processes you want to study, one expects that it will not have any physical effect, and one could use the gauge theory in principle to study these processes. So even though we started off by talking about extremely charged black holes, we are, at the end of the day, led to a formulation which describes ordinary black holes, Schwarzschild black holes, or Kerr, and in principle accretion disks in all of physics. by in some sense, coding this in the gauge theory. Now, I have to say that at the moment, people are working very hard to try to construct a dictionary which will relate concepts in the gauge theory to concepts in the space-time. In other words, this gauge theory, which has no gravity in it intrinsically, is supposed to be describing all of these gravitational phenomena, and so we need to know how to translate questions you want to ask about gravitational processes into questions that you can ask in the gauge theory. Once you have this dictionary, you can translate things in the gauge theory, do the calculation in the gauge theory, translate it back, and get your answer. So at the moment, there are only a certain sort of pieces of this dictionary which are now understood, and hopefully this will be cleared up more in the future. Well, I'm essentially out of time. Let me just point out a couple of further consequences of this conjecture, if we just accept it as true for the moment. First of all, and something which is of more interest to the particle physicist perhaps than the astrophysicist or relativist, this conjecture allows us to learn something about strongly coupled gauge theories. You see, we don't know much about strongly coupled gauge theories, but since it translates via this conjecture into a statement about string theory in this weakly curved background, you can do calculations that you couldn't do before. Things, properties of the gauge theory that you want to know can now be calculated using simple geometrical arguments by this duality. And in fact, in some sense, this closes a 30-year cycle, because string theory was originally invented in the late 1960s to try to understand strong interactions. Gauge theories came around in the 70s and worked much better, and basically threw string theory away as saying you're irrelevant for the strong interactions and the weak interactions. Now we see that these gauge theories have a certain limit in which they're looking a lot like string theory, and in some sense realizing this old idea that string theory would be relevant for the strong interactions. But of more interest to this audience is what the conjecture can tell us about quantum gravity. So I've already said this gives us a non-perturbative formulation of quantum gravity, and in particular this question that Steve Giddings discussed this morning, this long-standing question about whether black hole formation and evaporation violates quantum mechanics, whether you lose information in the evaporation of black holes, is now, in a sense, answered. If you believe this conjecture, we have a gauge theory, supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, which is a perfectly quantum mechanically consistent theory with an ordinary Hamiltonian evolution and obeying all the usual rules of quantum mechanics. And this theory is supposed to be able to describe the formation and evaporation of black holes. So we have indeed shown, modulo this conjecture, that black hole formation and evaporation can be described by a unitary process, and there is no loss of information. In terms of the possible outcomes that Steve discussed this morning, the one that turns out to be right is that the information simply comes out. The Hawking radiation at late time is correlated with the Hawking radiation at early time, and in the end of the day, all the information is recovered by studying the detailed properties of the Hawking radiation. Well, just to quickly summarize, what I hope I've convinced you of is that black hole entropy is not mysterious. It is just like ordinary entropy. It's a count, a measure of the number of quantum states of the system. We now understand in string theory how to count this for a number of black holes and how to reproduce Hawking radiation from a microscopic standpoint. We have this new, very different and surprising formulation of string theory in terms of an ordinary field theory. And what we need to do now is to explore this dictionary so we can translate gravitational concepts that we want to know the answer to into gauge theory concepts we can answer on the bulk, on the boundary. Thank you. Yes, there's been several papers. Well, first of all, there's a group of people who have started by basically quantizing space-time itself in a background-independent and diffeomorphism-invariant way. And in that framework, they have constructed operators associated with geometric quantities such as areas of surfaces. And they have shown that these operators have discrete spectra. So the area, for example, can only take certain discrete values. They have then applied this to black hole horizons and have counted the number of states in this framework, number of states living on the horizon of a black hole. And they get an answer proportional to the area. No, as I understand it, there's one undetermined parameter in this theory, something called the Amirzi parameter, but that one parameter is the same for all black holes. So if you fix it for Schwarzschild, it works for Reisner-Nordström. It works for, in fact, I think I recently heard it even works for cosmological horizons now and things like that. So they have one undetermined coefficient, but if you fix it once, you get the right answer in other cases. String theory predicts a unique coefficient for extremal and near-extremal black holes. That was the calculations I talked about. In this sort of road that I sort of described, one has led to this description of all of string theory, basically, in terms of this gauge theory. In principle, that should be reproducing the entropy of Schwarzschild, but people have not done that calculation yet.
When you exploit this connection to the supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, what, if anything, is left behind when a black hole evaporates?
We don't know for sure, but my guess is nothing. And the picture that we have is you take your Schwarzschild black hole and let it evaporate. And when it gets down to a small size of order the string scale, then the space-time geometry around this black hole sort of becomes ill-defined in string theory, and the black hole really sort of becomes some excited string state. And this excited string will continue to radiate, and it radiates into an unexcited string state, and the unexcited string state is just an elementary particle, like a photon. So the picture one has is that black holes just completely evaporate away. Ah, that's a very good question. One of the main sort of goals or here is to understand what happens to the classical singularities of general relativity. It's too early to tell what this gauge theory description says. Some of us believe that the answer is yes, that because the gauge theory is non-singular, that you will have, in some sense, evolution which will resolve the singularity inside the black hole. Other people argue that it's not, clear. We need to clearly sort of do the calculation, find out how to describe the black hole, find out how to describe somebody falling in, see what happens. But, yeah, that is one of the main things we want to understand. In cosmological situations also, the Big Bang singularity, we'd like to understand what that has to do in this sort of holographic framework.
Yes?
No.
If it comes out at the end, I don't understand how a tiny black hole can contain all the information. And if it comes out all along, that sounds better. But then I want to know what's wrong with the kind of black hole approximation in general relativity, which predicts it doesn't come out all along.
Good. Okay. Now, the answer, and I should say this is really, the calculations haven't been done yet. But the expectation is that the information will be coming out continuously. That's sort of what you need if you want to maintain this definition of the Hawking-Bekenstein entropy as the number of states inside. If the area is getting very small, you had better be having very few states inside. You can't store a lot of information inside a very small, with very little entropy. Okay, so the expectation is that the information is coming out all along. Okay, so now you say what went wrong with all those arguments people have been giving for years about how you can't get the information out without violating causality or something. And we don't know, but one possible resolution is that this holographic description is going to, I said it will give you, it only has finite resolution. It only gives you a local sort of description on some scale, and then it's going to break down. One possibility is that inside the event horizon of a black hole, this locality already is breaking down. and that in some sense the effective description of physics inside a black hole, even a rather large black hole, might be non-local. That's a guess. I mean, we have to really sort of see what the connection is, but that's one possibility.
As several people said, astrophysicists are interested in maximally rotating black holes, and you think they're always doing maximally charged black holes. Now, is that pure laziness, or is there some fundamental issue there in terms of difference between charge and angular momentum?
There is a difference in the sense that a maximally rotating Kerr black hole is not supersymmetric. Mm-hmm. So even though it is sort of stable in the sense of not having a Hawking temperature, it is not one of these things where we can sort of blithely extrapolate in coupling and count states at weak coupling. So that makes the problem harder. There are rough arguments which, well, pretty rough, but that there are some arguments which you can make in string theory of counting states to sort of reproduce the entropy of rotating black holes. And you get the answer right to a factor of, you know, two, or I mean a numerical factor of order one, but that's not so interesting because the entropy of a maximally rotating Kerr black hole is within a factor of order one from the entropy of a Schwarzschild black hole. So you haven't really learned that much about the rotation. There are other cases of rotating black holes in which people do have more information, but these are also black holes where you have charge and things are arranged so that they, so that the charge is also playing an important role. But it has been harder to sort of study directly the maximal Kerr black hole.
Another last question? Could
you say a little more about the gray body correction? I was taught that a redshifted black body spectrum remains a black body spectrum.
No, this is not a uniform redshift. This is a, you think of it more as a potential barrier that the radiation has to propagate through. And the high frequency modes go through more or less unaffected, and the lower frequency modes get distorted because of the potential. And that comes about because of the curvature of space outside the black hole. So you actually get a distortion of the... Yeah, I think that's the right scale.
Okay, thanks very much.